Hello and welcome to Women's Health Interrupted,
a Women's Health Research Cluster podcast.
I'm Rebecca Barron.
And I'm Sydney Clips. Through scientific inquiry and storytelling, this podcast brings you content about women's health from many angles. In her role with the BCCSU, Dr. Boyd collaborates with local and national peer-based drug user-led groups, as well as leads a program of qualitative and community-based research activities investigating drivers of drug-related harms among women, including barriers to harm reduction and the criminalization of women who use drugs.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Boyd, for being with us here today on this week's episode of The Gendered Impacts of Drug Policy on Women. So my first question for you is that research has shown that women use drugs differently, they respond to drugs differently, and can have unique obstacles to effective treatment. So in your opinion, in what ways can we highlight the unique needs of women in our policy and decision-making processes?
It's a good question, and it's a big one, so bear with me. Just in general, across the board, I would say women and gender diverse people are discriminated against in Canada. They make less money. They're more likely to live in poverty, to be victims of male violence, do more caretaking and housework than men. And these inequalities are heightened for racialized women, particularly Indigenous women, who experience poor health, such as higher rates of HIV and risk of overdose, than other populations of women. Because colonial practices have led to unequal access and support from health and social services for Indigenous populations. So women and gender diverse people who use drugs are more often second on the needle than men, which can lead to higher risk of HIV and hepatitis C transmission. They're more likely to hide their substance use for a variety of reasons. Fear of child apprehension being one of them. Regardless, it increases the risk of overdose if using alone, hiding your substance use. They have indicated a prevalence for smoking sometimes rather than injecting their drugs in some populations. But we know that few overdose prevention sites in Canada, for example, currently allow for smoking, although more are going this way. There is a gap in services for smoking drugs. They're more likely to require assistance injecting, which can increase the risk of violence and overdose if in requiring assistance in unsafe situations, for example. They're more likely to be single parents than men, but there's not a lot of drug treatment services that allow you to bring your children, and you certainly can't bring them to supervised consumption services. Racialized women, particularly Indigenous and Black women, are the fastest growing prison population, and not because they're more criminal, but because for a range of reasons, one of them being over-policed. And they're disproportionately affected by social stigma. They experience more barriers to accessing services, including experiences of racialized and gender-based violence, which can be a barrier to access. And this is particularly among sex workers and Indigenous populations and poor populations. So all of these things together, I think, indicate a need for targeted and adaptable interventions that should be community-directed, informed by those most affected, that are culturally appropriate and also responsive to historical and contemporary oppression. So what that means essentially is that we need services that are peer-led, led by people with lived and living experiences of substance use and the intersection of different oppressions that people are dealing with. They need to be culturally safe and gender diverse, and that means that they meet the needs of all women. So when I use the term woman, I'm using it to include gender diverse, transgender, and two-spirit people, of course, but I don't mean to homogenize their needs, which are varied. Services need to also step up for pregnant and parenting women, especially in relation to the overrepresentation of child apprehensions of Indigenous, Black, and poor women in Canada. For example, there's been some excellent recent research that's demonstrated that women whose children have been apprehended by the state are more likely to experience accidental overdose, particularly among Indigenous women. And it's not really surprising because apprehension has a lifelong impact on the parent, the child, and their family. So we need to take all of these things into account and highlight them when we're addressing our policy and decision-making processes. I think that somewhat covers that question in a long, detailed answer.
Indeed. Thank you. That was a wonderful overview. In terms of our research perspective, from your own work and experience with the BC Center on Substance Use, how do we start to incorporate more qualitative, more ethnographic, and community-based methods into drug research?
Yeah, and that's the kind of research I do. I only do qualitative, ethnographic, and community-based methodologies in my research. And there's a few reasons that I do this. Quantitative research is important, incredibly important, because we want to know, for example, how many people have died from an overdose. How are women particularly impacted in comparison to men? How many women have drug offenses? We need those numbers. But it's only through qualitative research that we can find out the why. What are the nuances? What is the context and the subtleties of what the daily life and experiences are of women who use drugs? And really only they can tell us how our policies impact them and how we might move forward to create better drug policies. So if you do community-based research, then you can work with the communities to see what questions are important to them. They can be engaged in all aspects of the development of the research questions so that they're relevant to the way that you're asking those questions. They can participate in how as researchers on your team to make sure that you're doing ethical and effective research when you're doing qualitative research. And then you can make sure that it's responsive to the community around the issues that you're hoping to address. Because, I mean, why else are we doing this research if we don't share those findings with the people whose lives we're trying to make better and with the people who can make the most impact, policymakers, for example, to make those changes. So I think qualitative research lends itself to those things as well. When you're doing ethnographic research, you can actually physically see things for yourself, which I think is always really useful. For example, if you're looking at experiences around services, if you actually go to the services, you know, you're in the place yourself, you can see firsthand some things that people may not feel comfortable talking about. And then you might be able to ask those questions more directly once you've experienced it firsthand.
Certainly. And thank you for highlighting both the value and the challenges of that.
Now, I mentioned it's important to partner with communities, but I also want to caution that that's difficult. It's been difficult during COVID, but in general, communities are dealing with their own issues of burnout, fatigue, grief. If they're dealing with things like poverty and criminalization, the burden has been put on them through lack of policy action to make changes. So it's a negotiation where you want to be able to support and enable their participation as well in your research process. So all of that is part of what I think is community engaged research, and it takes longer to do than non-engaged research. So how we enable that, I think there's a lot of different ways to do that, but one is thinking that it's important to highlight the voices of those populations that feature in your research questions, right? So one way is recognizing that that is an important form of evidence base. And so having that recognition and then doing the extra work, even though it takes longer, to make sure that it's more community oriented.
Absolutely. And I think that also building trust with communities, that is such an important dimension and needs to be recognized more in research. So another question that we had kind of tangentially to that was looking at an intersectional framework. So we know that intersectionality really looks at addressing addiction stigma through other forms of bias, how like racism and sexism might intersect within that. So in this regard, how has intersectionality been incorporated into our current drug policies and harm reduction strategies?
Has an intersectionality framework been incorporated into current policy? I would say not, as far as I'm aware, not formally, though, as you mentioned, there's some excellent research that does incorporate that framework and points to the need for it. And yes, there's some excellent harm reduction services that are informed by intersectional frameworks. And I can just think locally, for example, Sister Space, which is a women and gender diverse overdose prevention site, or FurSquare, which is a harm reduction program for pregnant women and mothers. That's an apprehension-free site. So yes, there's different services, but officially, there are platitudes about how addiction affects all people. But in fact, the consequences of our drug laws, policies, and stigma are not equal. Poor people, Black, Indigenous, and racialized people, as well as gender diverse people, are more discriminated against, profiled by the police, have less access to legal defenses, less choice in addiction treatment, if that's what they're interested in, and are overrepresented in prison. And as I said, not because they're more criminal, but because they're more visible on the street and more profiled. So this and all the reasons that I previously stated in the question beforehand, I think are an answer to that specific question.
I agree. I think we need to consider more of an intersectional lens, but applying that to current, like it hasn't been applied yet appropriately, I think, to current drug policies and harm reduction strategies. So maybe just disseminating that information and ensuring that the wider public knows that it is a framework that should be used.
Yeah, I think that there has been a lot of excellent research, but incorporating it into policy takes a lot longer, and also having people with lived experience, having their voices be heard in policy decisions will help push that forward.
And on that note, historically, I think a lot of barriers to awareness has been this historical tendency towards otherness still. This perception of women who use drugs and the way that they're portrayed. Are there ways outside of policy and research, in your opinion, that we can help shift this forward and away from this narrative, perhaps culturally as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is a different standard for women who use drugs compared to men. They're seen as doubly deviant because they break our ideas about gender norms, or they fall outside of them. And the illegal drug user for over a century has been framed as criminal and pathological. And women and gender diverse people are pathologized even more so, especially if poor or racialized. And part of that is that women have been stereotyped as moral, good, self-sacrificing caretakers and are often punished for transgressing those social constructs. Most of the drug services we've created are gender neutral, but are essentially geared towards cis men as the dominant norm. Of course, there is exceptions, like the Dr. Peter Center in Vancouver is an exception. But in order to shift away from that narrative, we need to ensure equitable access for all populations to services, and we need to consult with them rather than just assuming that we know what they need. So whether they be urban Indigenous or on reserve, women who are parenting, sex workers, youth, they know best from their own lived experiences where services have failed them and what they might need. So some recent research, as I mentioned, has been filling those gaps, but certainly we need more. And we need to see it implemented, not just reported on. So ultimately, we need a fundamental shift in our thinking about drugs and drug laws to understand that most harms that we associate with drug use come from punitive drug laws and policies rather than the drug itself that causes harm. But so the social and legal context of that drug use. I think that's one way to move away from this otherness.
Absolutely. And I would love to learn a little bit more about some of the research that you have done. So there was one article that I was reading called Women's Utilization of Housing-Based Overdose Prevention Sites in Vancouver, Canada. I was wondering if you can speak a bit more to the work that you did with that, and what were the results of the study?
I've written so many papers that being put on the spot about one particular study is difficult for me without prepping.
It was about, so it said 88% of fatal overdoses occur in the home. And I thought that that was really, really eye-opening, because women were facing a lot more violence when it came to actually accessing these overdose prevention sites. So I was wondering if you can speak a little bit more to that and how we can maybe improve women's safety when it comes to using drugs and what maybe that framework might look like.
Yeah, so I can speak more generally, not specifically to the article, I'm sorry, just because I've arranged. But yes, that's true. The majority of overdoses in Canada are happening in the home. And as I mentioned, women are more likely to hide their substance use for a variety of reasons. Women are more likely to experience a gendered and racialized based violence, and that can be intimate partner violence. And so they do experience a variety of barriers to accessing harm reduction services like overdose prevention sites. Having those sites we've now moved in Canada to have some supervised consumption sites within housing buildings, but that again only addresses substance use for poor and marginalized women, for example, who are living in those buildings. But women do experience precarious housing and face evictions, especially when reporting intimate partner violence, for example. So that can put them at increased precariousness of housing if they do so. So being able to find a safe way for women to be able to consume drugs without the risk of overdose has become quite complicated because of a range of those dynamics. So not only experiencing intimate-based partner violence if trying to access, overdose prevention sites outside of the home, but sometimes experiencing it within services like overdose prevention sites. It may not be your partner, but you can experience any kind of violence if you're being stalked by someone that can follow you into that site as well. So it's not always experienced as a safe place. Some women then prefer not to then access those services and continue to use alone at home, or they may not want to use if they have clients, if they're working as sex workers, because they don't want to experience violence if their client may not want them to use substances. They're more likely to hide that use before and after in different ways that can put them at risk of overdose.
So I guess if there's any other questions or things that you might want to cover that maybe we haven't touched on yet, I'll open up the floor to you just to add in any final thoughts or words on this issue.
Sure. I've mentioned that we need adaptable services that are tailored to those communities that need the services. But I want to emphasize that we don't only need to address the outcomes of poor health, but we also need to address root causes, structural barriers that impact women. So poverty, criminalization, colonialism. So this means that we need services tailored to the communities and it's people with lived experience who are best positioned to give us those insights. They should really be, helping direct those initiatives from the get-go all the way through to the development and service provision of those services. But in tandem with that, we need advocacy for policy change to address those larger structural issues that are affecting women. And also, we need to give people choices. So what might work for some women doesn't work for all women. What might work for some people who use substances doesn't work for everyone. So we need a range. We need overdose prevention sites. We need naloxone training. We need people to have access to heroin-assisted injection if that's what works best for them, so that they're able to maintain their everyday lives, go home and reconnect with their communities and not have to go in every hour in order to have access to opioid agonist treatment, for example. So, maybe some people still want recovery systems and we need to have those available too. So what we need is a wide range of services so that it's equitable for everyone. So everyone can benefit from the policies that we're creating.
Dr. Boyd, we want to thank you so much for taking the time today to speak with us and for the nuance and the dimensions with which you've covered this issue. Thank you for all of the work and research that you're doing on the topic.
Thank you. I so appreciate being able to speak about a subject that I feel so passionate about. So thank you again.
Got a few new synapses firing for you. Be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts to hear our episodes when they drop every second Wednesday each month.
Get in touch with us. We welcome any questions and constructive feedback.
You can email us at womenshealth.interrupted@ubc.ca
or find us on Twitter at @researchonwh
or on Instagram at @whrcluster.
To learn more about this topic, check out our show notes at womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca. We would like to thank the Michael Smith Foundation, BioTalent Canada, Patreon, and the UBC Global Lounge for their generous support of this project.
We would also like to thank the UBC Medicine Learning Network and its wonderful staff for hosting our podcast.
And a special thank you to Catherine Moore, who manages the Women's Health Research Cluster, for all of her work in the development of this initiative.
Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful day or evening wherever you are, and please take care of yourselves.
Wishing you
good health.
Enjoying UBC Medicine Learning Network presents on CITR. Check out the entire family of podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. Join the conversation and our community on social media. Follow at UBC MedVid on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn. That's UBC MedVid. You're listening to the UBC Medicine Learning Network.
This podcast was recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and stolen lands of the Musqueam people. We are committed to ensuring Indigenous women's rights to health and safety and the equal opportunity to participate in a manner that recognizes and respects Indigenous cultures and traditions.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Women's Health Interrupted. I'm Sarah Williscraft.
And I'm Chevy Mehra.
Today we are going to be discussing female sexual health and empowerment with Dr. Lori Brado. Dr. Lori Brado is a professor in the UBC Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and a registered psychologist in Vancouver, Canada. She has been the executive director of the Women's Health Research Institute since 2016. Dr. Brado holds a Canada Research Chair in Women's Sexual Health, and her research focuses on testing mindfulness-based interventions for women with sexual dysfunction and those who experience chronic genital pain. Her book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness: How Women Can Cultivate Desire, is a trade book of her research demonstrating the benefits of mindfulness for women's sexual concerns.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brado, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Dr. Brado, for over 15 years, you know, you've studied different aspects of women's sexuality, sexual desire, causes and effects. What are some of the most interesting revelations and research that you've come across during this process?
So many findings. I mean, first of all, when I started doing research on women's sexual health, which was the year that Viagra was approved in men, 1999 in Canada, very little was known about the contributors to sexual desire and arousal, how to cultivate these things, how to give people effective treatments. So over the years, it's really been these kinds of questions emerging out of my clinical practice that have guided the kinds of research topics that I do. So yeah, again, there's so many interesting findings. I think, you know, one of the really interesting findings that has guided much of my work is that sexual desire can be cultivated. It's not something that is fixed and unwavering. It's not something that's like a light switch that you turn on or off. It's something that is very responsive to context, to internal emotions and external triggers. And it is something that can be elicited or cultivated over the course of a person's life. So just that one finding alone, that our historic understanding of the nature of sexual desire was wrong, has been both fascinating and guided a lot of the work that I do.
You mentioned the cultivation of sexual desire. Could you talk a bit more about how it can be cultivated in the first place?
So I've been primarily interested in mindfulness-based interventions, and your listeners will probably be familiar with what mindfulness is. It's really kind of made its way into modern day healthcare, but even just everyday discussions. And mindfulness is really a practice that involves present moment, non-judgmental awareness. So it's a skill that we can cultivate. And what our research has found is, given that low sexual desire, especially in women, is often perpetuated by stress and distractions and catastrophizing and negative judgments and worries about how the sexual encounter will go. Also just kind of everyday distractions, minds being everywhere but the present moment. That is why we've adapted mindfulness, which for a long time has been applied mostly to managing pain and managing anxiety and managing depression. And we've applied it directly to these difficulties that people face when they have sexual dysfunction. So, and of course, the research has been fantastic. We've found that it's feasible, that people will do the exercises, that they'll keep doing the exercises even a year later, and that they really work to elicit sexual desire and reduce sexual distress. So mindfulness is definitely one way of cultivating desire. But once we accept that desire looks much like other emotions, right? So we feel sad when negative things happen to us. We feel happy when positive things happen to us. The same happens with desire. So from that perspective, another way to cultivate desire is to influence the environment that would then elicit sexual desire. So things like making sure that the kinds of stimulation that a person receives are appropriate for cultivating desire, making sure that the blocks in the environment that get in the way of desire, like worrying about kids walking in, worrying about the meeting you have tomorrow, like making sure that those things are not blocking the cultivation of desire. And those are all things that are very much within our reach.
And I think that perfectly leads to our next question about the quote unquote orgasm gap, which you talk about in numerous articles you've written over the years. Can you tell us what this is and what factors contribute to it?
The notion of the orgasm gap comes out of the much more common notion of the gender gap. And it's just in recognition that, like, when we look at the binary of men versus women, that there are a lot of domains where men historically have, quote, fared better than women have. So in terms of, you know, what we know just about kind of health and biology and medications and health promotion and treatments and all of that, we simply know a lot more about men's health than we do about women's health. And I think that's why this particular podcast has really been seeking to close that gap. When we extend that to sexuality, those same gender differences happen when it comes to orgasm. So why is that? Why is it that men have more frequent orgasms than women, that they're easier to reach than women? I mean, there's so many reasons. One really obvious reason is that there's been a very long-standing historic negative stigma that has clouded women's sexuality. You know, thank you, Freud, for declaring to the world that clitoral orgasms point to immature development in women, right? That was kind of Freud's psychosexual stages of development, that if you could just reach clitoral orgasms, that was a sign of immaturity and development. And so even though today we kind of refute those theories, they have this long-standing legacy that has meant that women have grown up with shame around touching their bodies, that they've grown up with the inability to ask for what they want to feel good, that they simply grow up with frankly, wrong information, such as vaginal orgasms are the be-all, end-all, and clitoral orgasms mean that there's something wrong or broken with you. So those are some of the reasons that contribute to this orgasm gap. I think having more conversations around normalizing women's sexual pleasure, talking about the health-promoting effects of masturbation and orgasm in women are really important part of reversing that and closing that gap.
You know, speaking of shame, growing up in India, just engaging in any form of sexual intercourse is such a taboo. And there aren't even conversations about pleasure or masturbation or exploring your sexuality as women because there's so much shame attached to the idea of pleasure and orgasm and such. And I was really jazzed about listening to your conversation about orgasm on We Can Do Hard Things by Glennon Doyle podcast. And you mentioned how, you know, women do experience arousal but feel stuck in their heads when it comes to sex. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the personal beliefs about sex, which can create, you know, struggles in our sex lives, and where do they stem from?
So we've tackled one, and one of them pertains to desire, this idea that, you know, you either have it or you don't. And if you don't have it, you know, the only way to fix it is a medication. And that's highly problematic because, as we've talked about already, the fact that desire is responsive, it emerges, it's cultivated, it's not a light switch, it's more like a dimmer. It's like a dimmer lever that goes up and down. So that's a really big one. There's so many age-related myths surrounding female sexuality too, like, you know, it goes down with age, and once you hit menopause, it's gone, and old women don't have sex, and old women don't fantasize. And I mean, every one of these that I'm rattling off is a myth, and we have data as well as anecdotal experience that directly counters them. Where do they come from? I think it's part of that historic, longstanding legacy that women are either nymphomaniacs or frigid. And those were the kind of two classifications that women were put into. So if you thought about sex too much, you were a quote nympho, which was an actual diagnosis that was given and is used in a really pejorative way still to this day. Or you were frigid if you didn't want sex enough, or if you said no to a partner. There was no room in between for consent, for asking for what you want, for, you know, maybe one day I do, one day I don't. Like, there wasn't just no room for that. And I think that is why having conversations like this, where we equip people with facts and science and information to help them appreciate that, number one, they're totally normal. And number two, that, you know, we need to counter these myths in order to really kind of find our own sexual wellness, if you will, our own sexual energy.
And in your work researching this topic and thinking about some of these conversations, have you noticed any differences in how we were in the past versus how we are now in terms of dismantling these myths?
Some yes and some no. And I think it's because my timeline has been too short. I've only been doing sex research for 20 years. So, you know, what I have seen in 20 years is funding agencies more willing to fund studies on sexuality beyond just focusing on treating the disease of sexuality, but, you know, granting agencies that will fund projects that look at what is pleasure and what is sexual well-being and how does it impact relationships. So there we've definitely seen some progress. We have also, you know, in the domain of sex education in schools, that's kind of gone all over the place. It's gone up and down. We have, you know, periods of time where we hear much more about good comprehensive sex ed being taught in the school, including female genital anatomy, including, you know, what are the different types of orgasm. And then there's a change in government and that kind of regresses back to, you know, pre-1950s level. So I think I'm optimistic about some of the signs of improvement, but we still have a long way to go.
You use the term non-concordance to describe mind and body separation. And you also talk about how non-concordance stems from stress and compulsive multitasking. Can you expand on this a little bit?
So non-concordance primarily came out of the psychophysiological literature. And so in our, you know, in our lab setting, we have the ability to measure both physiological sexual response. So people come in, they insert a vaginal probe called a vaginal photoplethysmograph, They sit on a comfy recliner. They watch some erotic films. And this little probe provides an indirect measure of physical sexual response. So the amount of light that gets backscattered from the vaginal wall, which is a correlate of kind of blood flow pooling into the genital area, gives this, quote, objective measure of sexual arousal. I say in, you know, big quotes, because it's just basically what the body is doing. And at the same time, while the participant is sitting in the chair and watching the erotic films, they're using a little lever that they move back and forth to correspond with how turned on they are in their mind. Then we as researchers look at the degree of agreement between what the body is doing while they watch the films with what their mind is saying. And 9 times out of 10 in women, you find that there is low agreement between physiological and self-reported arousal. So it might be that the person's watching the film and the body's showing, you know, a massive physiological response and their self-report is meh, or I'm mildly turned on, but not hugely turned on. So that's where the discordance term came from, is this phenomenon that happens real time, that there's not this good synchrony between physiological and self-reported response. But we can extrapolate that lab finding into real everyday lives. And as a clinician, you know, who does sex therapy, this is pretty much what I hear from my patients who are seeking treatment. They'll say, yeah, I lubricate and yeah, I feel pulsing in my vagina, but I'm thinking about my shopping list, or I'm worried about how I smell, or I'm thinking about, did I turn the stove off, or sex hurts and I'm just thinking to myself, I want to get this over with. So that discordance between physical response and emotional response definitely plays out in the real life sexual encounters that a lot of people experience, and is largely the reason why I've been interested in mindfulness techniques as a way of bridging those two. Because one of the things that we do in mindfulness is we bring full awareness to the body and the sensations in the body, and away from the distractions, the negative storylines, the catastrophizing. And indeed, what our research has found is that by integrating these two, which we can measure through interoception, there's different ways of measuring interoception, but interoception basically means bringing together the mind and the body and bringing more awareness of the mind to what's happening in the body, that improvements in interoception directly underlie or mediate, in statistical terms, the improvements that we see in sexual desire after people do a mindfulness program.
Do you think these distractions disproportionately affect women? And if so, what do you think maybe the root causes for that?
You know, it's a tricky question to answer because I don't want to reinforce gender stereotypes of, you know, women being distractible and, you know, not able to focus. And this is something that cognitive scientists have been studying, and I've been following that science, and it kind of goes back and forth all over the place, that while there is evidence that women are more likely to multitask than men are, and there probably are hormonal reasons for that, neurophysiological reasons, there's probably very sociocultural gendered reasons for that. So if we look at the kind of heteronormative script of the woman who, in addition to having her regular tasks, she's maintaining the household, she's scheduling the doctor's appointments, she's driving kids to soccer, she's, you know, planning the parties, all of that. So that kind of multitasking tends to happen more by women than by men. Again, that's just kind of part of the heterosexual script. Doesn't fit same-sex attracted people or in other kind of relationship configurations. Some of those heteronormative scripts don't fit. So I just want to preface this by saying I'm really talking about, say, the mixed gender pairing where that is happening. So there probably is some kind of cultural and gendered explanations for why women multitask more. And then there's probably some physiological explanations as well, that, you know, when, again, men are engaging in sex, the kind of feedback from the body is so much more obvious to them. Men know when they have an erection, right? They can see it, they can feel it, they know it intimately. It's been celebrated, it's been rewarded throughout their life. And you ask that same question of women: do you know when your body is physically aroused? Do you know when you are lubricating? Many of them will have no idea. And they'll say, well, I know if I put my hand there and sense it, but I don't know it kind of intuitively.
What is the relationship between pleasure and sexual empowerment?
Pleasure is the measure, right? Pleasure has been the missing frontier in much of our research on sexuality. In my own lab, we have three studies that we're doing right now on pleasure because our field has recognized that we've been ignoring this. You know, lack of pleasure is the reason why people go to treatment. Lack of pleasure is the reason why people don't wear condoms. So pleasure really has been missing from our science, from our conversation. And we've been, I think, almost even over-focusing on the more, quote, functional parts like intensity of desire, number of orgasms. So pleasure has been really key. Really recommend that your listeners read Adrienne Marie Brown's book, Pleasure Activism, which is just a mind-blowing tour de force around the role of pleasure in our life, like beyond orgasms and beyond sexual wellness, how pleasure shows up in our day-to-day interactions and how our connection with our pleasure guides our self-identity. And again, how we carry ourselves in many domains of our life. So I'm really excited about our own work on pleasure now. One of my PhD students is developing a measure of sexual pleasure. And I have another student who is developing a bit of a psychoeducational intervention for people on what does pleasure look like? How do you cultivate it? Some facts around sexual pleasure. So I'm super excited about that. And others are also doing work on sexual pleasure too, which I'm really looking forward to.
And what do you think women can do to care for their sexual health and feel more empowered? And I know you also published a book on better sex through mindfulness. Mm-hmm. So if you could reference that, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm so thrilled to be having this conversation with you today. So one thing that a listener can do is mention this recording to a friend, or if you, you know, post it on your social media, encourage people that you know and care about and trust to create a space to have conversations about sexual pleasure and sexual wellness. Part of the reason why I wrote the first book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness, was because the experiences of our research participants in our scientific studies was so profound and positive. And, you know, many of them said to me, all right, Dr. Brado, besides your peer-reviewed publication, how are you going to get this information out there? And I never thought I would write a book, but it was really the urging of those participants that said, yeah, this information shouldn't just stay buried in peer-reviewed journals. So that's why I wrote the 2018 book. And then after that book came out, I had a whole bunch of people around the world contact me and say, okay, you've convinced me that mindfulness is part of the kind of sexual well-being picture. How do I do it? So then I wrote the Better Sex Through Mindfulness workbook, which just came out the end of 2022. And it provides all the skills and walks people through the exercises on how they might practice this in their own lives.
Thank you, Dr. Brado, for joining us, and to our listeners for tuning in.
We would also like to thank the UBC Medicine Learning Network, the University of British Columbia, and everyone that has donated to the Women's Health Research Cluster for their support of this project.
If you want to help transform women's health on a global scale, donate to the Women's Health Research Cluster today at www.womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca.
If you liked the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts on to be notified when new episodes drop every second Wednesday of the month.
And check out our show notes online to dig into the resources we talked about today.
We also have other exciting women's health research being shared on our Women's Health blog and through events like the Women's Health Seminar Series. So make sure to head over to our website at womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca to learn more. Until next time, I'm Chavi Mehra.
And I'm Sarah Willis-Craft. Thanks for listening.
Enjoying UBC Medicine Learning Network podcasts? Then you'll love our YouTube channel. Watch our award-winning medical educational media today at youtube.com/UBCMedVid. That's youtube.com/UBCMedVid. This has been a presentation of the UBC Medicine Learning Network.
My feelings are a tender thread. I'm trying not to get ahead. It's clear. it. The biggest yet. I better get it. I better let it. This is it. The biggest yet. I better get it. I better let it.
Above head, hands clasped together.
What is it that you want from me? If it's vibes, then you already know I want to share. What is it that you want from me? Got all night, we be partying without a care. What is it that you want from me? Whatever it is, I do it properly. But somebody should tell me what they want from me. What is it that you want from me? I put my heart into this art on my mental. So what if it's not a picture that I draw with my pencil? You could see it in the blood that you could draw from my vessel. Insults in my heart, son, the punch in the jaw is essential. Sometimes I speak controversial, but a lot of it's gentle. It's just that sometimes what's in our face is all from the devil. Real know when they listen to my songs on the metro, all in their headphones, that sometimes I just gotta say what they don't wanna say, so I speak up, say my piece, put these up, say la vie, then ease up. If you listen, good, but if not, so what? It's okay by me. What I spit is my business, and if you listen, I get it. If you didn't, good riddance, your mother ain't my position. My mic is my best friend. I knew it forever, and I like that if I vent. We do it together. I talk and it listens. Documents my visions. Possible revisions. Then I send it to the world.
What is it that you want from me? If it's vibes, then you already know I wanna share. What is it that you want from me? Got all night, we be partying without a care. What is it that you want from me? Whatever it is, I do it properly. But somebody should tell me what they want from me. What is it that you want from me? Yeah. If you wanted, I could give some incredible vibes. Make you feel so good that it's bad like a federal crime. All my lyrics that feel as good as any man I rhyme. My drop from my music comes above any man in my mind. Ever since I was 12, I had a passion for rhymes. And that was before sports, dancing, or guys. It's what I want for myself and what they want from me, too. Eliminate the competitions, what they want me to do. And it ain't hard for me, neither. I got you suffering in a pond of my ether. Promise I'ma be the best you ever heard. And I got you physically acting on my every word. Yeah, I mean every verb. While I smoke that loud, I mean every herb. I'm very independent, my parents let me learn. If you wanna be a fine, just know if you really ain't with a mind. I ain't a that ain't what I do. I am just a poet that's written a few haikus. I am more important than anybody I knew. I mean anyone at my job or anyone at my school. On par with the rappers, you ain't one of them. Look at him, silly nigga, remember you ain't Eminem. You a punk, you and I for me. Turn to my fans, ask them what they want from me. What is it that you want from me? If it's vibes, then you already know I wanna share. What is it that you want from me? Got all night, we be partying without a care. What is it that you want from me? Whatever it is, I do it properly. But somebody should tell me what they want from me. What is it that you want from me? What is it that you want from me? If it's vibes, then you already know I wanna share. What is it that you want from me? Got all night, we be partying without a care. What is it that you want from me? Whatever it is, I do it properly. But somebody should tell me what they want from me. What is it that you want from me? What is it that you want from me? What is it that you want from me? I don't know what they want from me. Want from me? What is it that you want from me?
Thank you. make you feel lucky, lucky. And she the only one that gon' make you feel lucky, lucky. Oh, baby, you know the deal. Lucky, lucky. And she the only one that gon' make you feel lucky, lucky. I be like in the go. I don't want nobody else in my boat. I'm tryna float. I got this girl up on my pillow. She about to roll. Driving like Nancy. Everything is who you know. She looking at me like a photo. Got the photograph. Jumping on me like a horse. She made me jump around.
Everly from Dead Circle Haunt, a nature-based music show here on CITR. This week here at CITR, it's Fun Drive. The one time a year we ask you to support our programming with a donation, ideally in the name of your favorite show, Dead Circle Haunt.
Look, we're asking for your support to help us keep local, independent, alternative voices on air. So if you can, please donate at donate2citr.ca.
I said yes to CITR because the programming and studio managers believed in me as a student. I was playing songs that had meaning to me and my passions of the outdoors and nature. I hope that's why you and your houseplants continue to tune in Thursdays at 5 p.m. to Dead Succulent Haunt.
If Dead Succulent Haunt has meant something to you, if CITR is your preferred station here in Vancouver, support us at donate2citr.ca. That way we can continue our presence as